Daddy, we're doing?
I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy.
Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I'm your host, Yannick, and on today's episode, we are talking about special educational needs, and I've got a SEND expert with us today, and I'll allow them to introduce themselves.
Thanks for having me. My name's Nana. I'm a SEND practitioner. I work in senior management for a local authority. I'm also the CEO and lead consultant of a consultancy SEN agency called SEN Bites.
Great stuff. Thank you, Nana, for joining us today. So just for a bit of context, Nana and I went to school together. Yep. A couple of years above me. And before we sort of kick off, I want to start off there. I want to start off with school. And because I was thinking about this on the way here.
Yeah.
What was your memory of SEND in school? Was that something that was like discussed about? Did you see it in certain students, or like what was your memory of what SEND looked like when we went to school?
Do you know what? Now, with my SEND hat on now, I feel bad for some of the kids that went to school with us, because I don't think it was really recognized and picked up on a lot in school at that time. I don't think there was a lot of knowledge or information. So I think what our school was doing was those young people that probably had additional needs, they were just all grouped in like the bottom set,
yeah.
or the lower set, when really they had like complex needs. They weren't able to navigate like us. They weren't given the support. They were just thrown into one box. They were probably labeled as troublemakers and so on forth. But when I think back, there's kids that we were all friends with, my year group, your year group, but they probably had underlying needs, but it wasn't picked up on it. There wasn't a lot of information back then. Now there's a lot of early identification of needs. That's like something that local authorities push. That's what the government push. Healthcare pushes it. There's a lot of early identification where I don't think that was the case before. So in a way, I think a lot of young people that were having difficulties then were essentially being punished because they had needs. But they didn't know their needs. The teachers didn't know. The parents didn't know. Or maybe parents had a suspicion, but they didn't want to accept it.
Yeah.
And then that's when you have issues moving down the line, because now there's a lot of young people being diagnosed quite early. People have mixed views. I think it's a good thing, because that means you can get the support early on. And then when they get older, they'll be able to manage and cope with their needs more better and more efficiently. Yeah. Whereas in school, people were probably seen as like off key or weird or whatever kind of label that you wanted to give them. Yeah. But I don't think that back then there wasn't information or knowledge on it.
Yeah. No, that's true. And I think, you know, perhaps looking back with additional support or, you know, tailoring their work, scaffolding their work, they could have perhaps engaged in maybe like the middle or like some of the higher sets, like with additional support. And, you know, I'm thinking even about the LSU, like the learning support unit.
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking back on that and I'm thinking, where was the support in that place?
None.
You used to just walk about and like sometimes like a teacher wasn't even there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the students within there were just gallivanting and doing whatever they want. And I'm talking from experience, because I was
you
in
was there. You was really
you know,
there.
A few times,
.
But that was, like you said, it was more behaviour. Yeah. So it wasn't nothing to do with, you know, academic, because academically I applied myself, but they'll just throw anyone in there. Oh, behaviour, you've got learning needs and whatever else. Yeah. You know, everyone would just get thrown in there. And when you talk about, like, early identification of, like, you know, learning needs now, I think it's important, because when I reflect back on school as well, I don't remember the word autism being used. No. I don't remember the word ADHD. If there was a student in my year group with ADHD or autism, I couldn't tell you who they are.
Facts, 100%. Unless it's a visible need, then nobody's really going to notice it. Unless it's like a physical need.
Yeah, but even the students that we thought, you know, this person's a bit
different.
Like, we would have different words for them.
Yeah. You know? But it would never be
a
specific diagnosis.
But I didn't see it as like a learning need. You just have like rude, you know, I'm not going to obviously disclose. But we was never seen it as a learning need. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's interesting as well, you know, and it'll be interesting maybe in a future episode to have a teacher who's maybe retired mm-hmm. or has been in education for a long time to sort of get a better understanding of actually, you know, when did autism and ADHD and learning needs become prevalent? Mm-hmm. Were these things that teachers and schools were looking for and trying to support, mm-hmm. You know, students with, or is this something that's, you know, more like more new to the field of education?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because back then they would have had what you would have called back then statements, where now we call them educational healthcare plans.
Mm.
So that changed in 2014, 2015. So if the educational healthcare plan is basically a document that obligates the local authority to fund, support that young person's education from the age of 0 to age 25.
Yeah.
But before they had statements which were probably like a few pages long, didn't really have that much key information, just basic standard information.
Were they statutory, the statements as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but even with that, and when I think back when we was in school, the most you had was the LSU unit. So if you had a young person that is having issues with regulating their behaviour, it's not because they're naughty or they're bad. It's literally they've got a need that needs to be met. But because the teacher's not aware of it, the young person hasn't been explained what their needs are, then their immediate trigger response is, I'm going to misbehave and let me just go chill in the LSU.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, literally. But if the needs were identified earlier, they would have been able to put a strategy in place that'll help them regulate. And then they probably wouldn't be like on point straight away, but over time they would have been able to self-regulate.
Of course.
Whereas now there's loads of opportunities for that, whereas before there wasn't that. So I'm thinking about it now. When I was sitting in class, there'll be one of my friends or someone in the classroom that's doing something that's seen as bad behavior, or they're not what's the word they used? They're not non-compliant.
Yeah.
And they're leaving the classroom, they're walking around, blah, blah, blah. But literally they could have some sort of sensory need. They could have some emotional need, some sort of physical need.
Classwork-based avoidance. You're thinking, oh, you know what? This is too hard for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do it. Yeah, I don't want to show that I'm not capable of doing
exactly.
it. So I'm just going to shout or swear or start a fight with
That's
another
it,
student.
And I'm going.
Yeah.
That's it.
And
That's
I don't
it.
Have to do the work.
Exactly. It could be in... And I think even when you go back, it could be certain subjects that child is always doing, that maybe he always does it in maths.
Mm.
Others are, but maths, he doesn't know how to handle it. So he's always starting trouble in maths and then he goes.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want to face it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a weird one. When I look back, I do feel sorry for them, because I don't think there was a lot in place for them. And even in terms of curriculum, there probably should have been a lot more emphasis on like more practical based stuff, and as opposed to like tabletop academic stuff as well. They could have been more creative, like looking at things like construction, plastering, all that stuff. I don't think our school really pushed and promoted it like that, because I think that with those sorts of areas, it's almost seen as you're only doing that because you're not smart enough to do psychology or law or whatever. But we need people in construction, we need people to do plastering. So they could have been a lot more creative with what they were delivering in terms of the curriculum.
And, you know, it's about offering diverse pathways. And I think that's
exactly.
that's a national issue, that, you know, beyond the English, maths, the sciences, you know, what can we gain from the technologies, the creative arts, the music, and, you know, all of these other practical fields to really, you know, boost and develop a young person's, you know, academia. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk as well, because you've been working in SEND for some time now.
Yeah.
And one of the thing that's common within that area is the over-representation of black boys within the SEND category, whether it's, you know, ADHD, autism, or SMH needs. And I just wanted to know, like, what are your thoughts on that? And what are some of the things that we can do to address it?
I think it's a very, there's so many layers to that. Definitely one thing that I think needs to be considered is representation in schools of obviously black male and female staff, not just teachers at like the highest level, if possible. Because when I think back to when we was in school, we were lucky, we was in a school where there was a majority black and Asian kids, and we had actual black teachers that could relate to us and speak to us. So it's, even if you were misbehaving and doing something silly, and some of the teachers had enough of you, you got Mr. whoever, maybe Mr. Odell or Mr. Mensah, someone they can pull to say, hey, relax, stop what you're doing. Because if you don't get that, you can get quickly put in a category of you're not able to like manage your emotions, and then it'll get escalated quickly, and before you know it, you're done, you're permanently excluded and stuff. So yeah, it's a difficult one. With the ADHD and ASD diagnosis, I do think within black culture, it's a lot of difficulty with accepting that your son or daughter might have these needs. So I think before, they were resistant to like go for like assessments and getting diagnosed. But I think now, because there's a bit more information, and I think parents are conscious now that the sooner I get this done, the more help I'm gonna get. There's less delay with going to get these assessments and stuff. So I think that's something that's building up the numbers in terms of like black boys getting diagnosed with ASD and ADHD. But on the flip side, when we're looking at girls, girls is a very difficult one. So typically girls with ASD and ADHD, they mask their behavior. So they'll be in school and they've got all of these needs and battles going on internally, but they internalize it. And then when they come home, then it explodes. But at school, they're able to like manage it. But then they get diagnosed a lot later, which is not a good thing because they're not getting the help early enough.
Because they're, it's the, maybe that thing of like adultification as well, like, oh, you're a girl, you're more smarter or you're more mature than a boy. So it's that expectation to be able to handle, you know, certain things because of your gender, when that's not always the case.
Exactly. I think typically girls are better at communicating things a little bit better than boys, whereas boys, it definitely spills out in the form of behaviour. That's what behaviour, meltdowns, having outbursts, lashing out. So it's more obvious when they're showing that sort of behaviour, the school can be like, okay, this young person, he's definitely got something got going on. We need to go and get him assessed. We need, so we can unpack what's happening. So we know what we're going to do moving forward. So yeah, it's a difficult one. I don't think it's a bad thing that there's a lot of young black boys being labeled as that, because we know that there's something wrong. But then at the same time, it's a difficult one because there's an issue with diagnosis. Especially with the NHS, there's like 2-3 year waits for you to get a diagnosis of ASD or ADHD. So some parents, if they've got money, they're able to like pay for something private. They can skip the queue and get diagnosed privately. But
and they're always going to get a diagnosis.
If you're paying a pediatrician $1,000, $2,000, they're going to do it. That's what I don't like. And you can't always challenge it as well.
How do you police that? How do you police that? You know, because that's,
I don't think there, I'm sure there's probably some types of regulations. I know that, for example, with me, with work, so when we see these private diagnoses, we need to see some sort of like co-sign from NHS. So if that practitioner's coming from an NHS background, they'll be stamped as, all right, that's fine. We can't really contest or debate that. It is difficult because people take advantage of the system as well.
Take advantage of families as well.
Yeah, there's parents that know specifically that if my child has this label, he's going to be able to access X, Y, and Z. So let me just get a private diagnosis and then we'll go from there.
And I think that's one of the things that I find difficult as well, or I have an issue with, is that there could be some parents or families that just want the diagnosis as a means of, oh, now you can't complain about my child's behavior because they've got ADHD.
Yeah.
They've got ADHD.
Yeah.
Like just bringing it down to ADHD and leaving it to the school and not really taking some accountability in terms of what could I be doing, you know, as a parent to support my child, or what could I be doing as a parent to support my child's needs. And the other issue with the diagnosis as well is that if we consider trauma, like trauma and learning needs, a lot of the behaviors
overlaps
yeah. and they're quite similar, or mm-hmm. a lot of the behaviors can coexist. So we can be rushing to give a child a diagnosis, but it could be a trauma. Yeah. It could be like a trauma that they've, mm-hmm. you know, had from childhood that's been unmet, you know, they haven't worked on it. And it will still become an issue in later life, and you'll still see it whilst the diagnosis is present.
Yeah, it's a very tricky one. It's a very slippery slope. So even sometimes, for me, my experience, because I've only worked in two schools and they've both been special needs schools. So the first school I worked in was a school for autistic children with every end of the spectrum. And I worked in another school, special school, but I had young people with a range of needs. There are young people that have difficulties, whether they've got a diagnosis or not, that they're expressing challenging behaviours or difficulties of communication, but then sometimes it's environmental. You put them in a different environment or a different class, it's like a different child, or you put them with a different teacher and it's somebody completely different. So these are some of the things that need to get unpacked and looked at as well.
Yeah.
It's not just, there's so many different factors that can have an impact on a child. Even there's young people that you probably worked with that something changes in a family home, then their behavior goes up or down.
Yeah.
A lot of it is environmental as well. There's so many different layers to these children, especially if they've got special needs, then it's an additional layer. But a lot of things need to get factored in. And even with the diagnosis thing, I worked in a special school where you can't come into that school unless you've got ASD diagnosis. And having a diagnosis doesn't mean that you're not able to access learning, make friends, follow the rules, set a good example. Like, the label shouldn't really put a cap on them if you've got good practitioners and you're in a good environment.
Because
I've seen so many examples of young people making progress from here all the way here, and they've all got diagnoses as well. So it's a funny one. Some people will see the label and just give up.
Yeah.
But there's still a way to move forward. You just have to just navigate in a different way.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And if we're thinking about parents, sometimes navigating school in general is sometimes difficult for parents, even just for like basic information.
Yeah, of course.
You know, when's the parents' evening and when's, whatever else.
Yeah, yeah.
So like trying to navigate SEND as a parent, if, you know, you don't know these acronyms like EHCP and ASD and whatever else, like what sort of support or advice or guidance can you give parents who have kids who have either learning difficulties or suspected learning difficulties, in terms of like, how do they navigate that with school, in terms of like building, you know, a concise, you know, sort of chain of communication?
There's different, so you can obviously speak to your GP if you want to make that referral for an assessment, but then the GP should also have any additional information around the needs of a child, speaking to the school SENCO or inclusion lead on a regular basis, call meetings, put things in writing, ask questions, speak to the teacher as well. Obviously, I want to say go online, but then there's a lot of misleading information online. So I would say probably stick to the DfE, Department for Education websites, NHS website. That's a good thing as well. Maybe speak to other parents that have young people with special needs as well. There's like loads of different angles, but there is a lot of misinformation out there as well. But I would say definitely start with your GP, your school SENCO or inclusion lead, and the school teacher. Start from there and then go to your local authority. Every local authority has a SEND IS team. So it's a non-statutory service where they provide information and advice for parents that have children with special needs.
Yeah. Do you think education systems and schools are conscious of like the cultural context of families when trying to address like SEND needs, in terms of understanding that certain cultures might not accept it, that certain cultures might be thinking, you're talking about ADHD,
yeah,
like my child ain't got that,
yeah,
like especially within, you know, our community,
mm-hmm.
and that essentially creates a barrier, because mm-hmm. it means that from the get-go, your parents are not even consenting to an assessment.
Exactly.
Because they don't, you know, accept it. Do you think, you know, systems like NHS and CAMHS and, you know, education and SENCOs are really conscious of that and mindful of actually how do we navigate this, you know, cultural landmine when engaging with families?
They're conscious of it, but there's only so much they can do. So even with me, my role specifically, so I'm a manager of a preparing for adulthood team. So I deal with young people from year 9 all the way up to age 25. And essentially I oversee all of those young people that have educational healthcare plans. So even with that, like you said, with the assessments, they have to consent. You can't do anything without consent. There's literally nothing you can do. I think the only way it can be overridden is if there's like a safeguarding concern. If there's a safeguarding concern, then whatever the parent says or does is basically void. But if we're talking about identification or special educational needs, local authorities, schools powerless unless parents do it, because the whole point of it is to be doing it in collaboration, because that's what the legislation pushes and promotes, that parents, schools, professionals should all be working together, not really against each other. So it's a slippery slope. If I've got a situation where a school has come to me to be like, Nana, we need an educational healthcare plan for this young person in our school. If they send in the paperwork, if I don't see the parents have consented, we have to send it back.
Yeah,
it's illegal. We can't do it without their consent. So I guess all of these professionals, the schools, they're aware of it, but they're kind of capped in what they can do. Unless it's safeguarding, then it's different.
Right.
And then obviously this, parents have their choices as well. If they feel that it's too much of a battle, they can just homeschool.
Yeah.
They can homeschool, or they can send their young person abroad, or they can choose a different school. Because some parents, I've seen them not accept it, because parents will, what some parents will do is if their child behaves some kind of way at home, but behaves a different way at school, they're like, well, at home he's fine.
So they blame it on the school?
Yeah, so you don't know what you're doing. I've had parents speak to me on the phone and be like, Nana, this school don't know what they're doing, but this school's been outstanding like X amount of years in a row. They've got a good reputation for managing SEND, but some parents don't want to accept it. And if they're not in the school seeing it...
And how can they behave the same at home? It's a different environment. When you was talking about the environment at home, they're not around...
There's no demands.
20, 30, you know, of their friends being told to do their classwork or line up or do whatever else. So, yeah, you make a valid point. And... You know, you spoke earlier about representation, and one of the things that, you know, I feel is important, and I try to voice time and time again, is the importance of representation, like within our field of education for young people and students to see us, not only in terms of being, you know, inspired or aspiring to, you know, I want to become a teacher, or I want to become a SEND leader, or I want to help other students. But also in terms of like building connections, trust, having that safety, which when a child is meant to connect with you or is allowed to connect with you, you engage with them better. You allow yourself or they're in an environment where you can support them much more better and you know, deal with their needs. In SEND, like within the SEND field, from my experience, I haven't seen many, not that I haven't seen none, I haven't seen many black professionals within the SEND field. And I haven't seen any black males within the SEND field.
Yeah.
So, like, what does it look like for you in your day-to-day across like your experience, not just in your current role, but in previous roles? Like, what did representation look like for you in your day to day when, you know, you're going to schools and speaking with SENCOs or you're in those, you know, strategies or multi-agency meetings, you know, with local authorities? So I'll be keen to know more about that.
So from my experience, so when I go back, so when I started as I was a teaching assistant in a special school, it was quite mixed The thing is, there's a lot of representation at the on the ground. But when you get higher up, it's less and less to basically none. So from when I started as a teaching assistant, it was quite mixed. Then when I done my master's in special needs, it wasn't that diverse at all. I think I was the only black man on my course, and there was quite a lot of people on my course as well. So yeah, so there was no, even from before I even got in the door, in terms of my career properly, the representation was lacking. If you work in different local authorities where the cohort of people there is a lot of white people, so I've worked in, I worked basically like near Surrey, the population is a lot of white people, so in the workplace, it's got to be a lot of white people. Mm. But in terms of my experience specifically, in terms of black men in SEN, I've only seen them on the ground level or a certain level. When they get to my level or maybe higher than me, like head of service or director of children's services, there's none. There's a lot. I think if you go into social care, there's probably a bit more. Social care, there's like loads of black women. Like NHS nurses, there's loads of black women. But in terms of black men, there's not really that much in SEN specifically. I've made friends over the years. A majority of the ones that I know that I'm cool, close with, they're not black men. Mm. Like I've got a couple of them, but there's not that many. And I don't know why that is. Mm. It is something that always confuses me. I feel like education generally is a female dominated field.
Yeah.
I think that's the same with social care service as well. I don't know if it's because it's more seen as more nurturing.
Yeah.
Or something. I don't know, maybe it's the stigma around that, but there's definitely not a black, there's so many meetings, multi-agency meetings. So I chair panels sometimes. 9 out of 10 times, the only black man there.
Mm.
All the time. A lot of those meetings at that high level, there's not a lot at all. And it's funny because when I speak to them and tell them about my experience, they're like, oh, really? I'm like, yeah, like I've got a degree, done a master's, so I know it from top to bottom. I know it from working in the schools hand to hand with these kids, then now working for the local authority, making decisions around funding, placements, commissioning, and all of this stuff. So yeah, there isn't a lot of representation. I don't know why that is. My only thing I can think of is because education, social work, those sort of fields are more, I can say there's got like a nurturing kind of title, and nurturing is probably normally linked to women.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And you know, you've been speaking a bit about your rise and your experience, and I wanted to sort of get an understanding, like how has it been sort of rising up and going into like a senior level, and what are some of, you know, the challenges you've experienced? Because I think one of the things that I'm sort of conscious of, especially, you know, in the work that I do within the local authority, is, you know, you go into schools, you're speaking to like head teachers and senior leaders, and you know, whether it's my age, whether it's my race, whether, you know, they're just sort of questioning my competency. Yeah. Sometimes it's a bit difficult to get, you know, the things that you want done and put in place, despite, you know, the perceived like seniority or the level of role or my experience or qualifications. And I wanted to know, like, how has the journey been for you, and what sort of challenges have you had to face?
Yeah, I think, yeah, working in SEN generally is a challenge, but then working in SEN as a black man, it adds another layer of challenge as well, because I feel like to some degree you have to probably prove yourself a bit more.
Mm.
So it's like I've worked as a service manager. So within that tier hierarchy, there's not many roles higher than that. But then sometimes you do get, like I've had before, I've sent emails out, and obviously I've got my email signature that says my role specifically. So I might email a head teacher or Senko challenging something or disputing something, and I've received responses like, oh, who are you? What's your role? But you can see clearly in the email signature what my role is and stuff. So when you go and contribute into these meetings, you just have to just stay strong and just reiterate and reaffirm who you are and what you do. When you go into these meetings, it is good, because normally at the start of these meetings, they ask people to do introductions. Sometimes just try and skip that, but I'm like, no, let's do that. So everybody's crystal clear.
That I'm levels.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I'm not here to just joke. I'm not here. I'm not a note taker.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not here to take notes. I'm not just anybody. I'm really somebody that I'm making a big contribution to this. So you just have to have, like, not arrogance, but you definitely need to have confidence, because if you don't, they're going to walk all over you. And it's funny because a lot of the people at the level that I've been at, or let's say I even go higher, it's more than likely going to be like older white women and older white men that have had a different sort of experience. So maybe there was like a head teacher or something before. They were head teacher for 25 years and they decided that, yeah, they just want to do this now until they retire. Mm. The thing is with SEN, there's not like a clear pathway. So it's kind of like, it's a bit scatty compared to like teaching, for example. You have to do a PGSE, PGC, then you go into teaching. If you want to be a doctor, you have to do medicine before you, if you want to be a lawyer, you have to do law. With special educational needs, it's like an amalgamation of so many different
fields,
people from different experiences. Yeah. A lot of the people that are like heads of service or like that are sitting at the top, they maybe were leading social care or leading like health commissioning for 15 years. They're about to retire. Let me just go and take this job because it's paying me six figures or whatever, and then I'm going to retire. It's a bit of a scatty kind of feel, but that's why when you're in it, you have to really show and prove.
Yeah.
Because you can be here 1 minute and gone the next.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And I think it'll be good to sort of share with the audience, especially with anyone listening who works in SEND, is passionate about the work that they do within SEND and the children that they work with. In terms of like elevating yourself and going to those next steps or going into those senior position, like what were some of the barriers that you faced that you can sort of give advice and guidance to people who are maybe coming up and they may not have the service manager experience or whatever, but you know, you're just sort of saying to them, okay, these are the sort of things that you need to be mindful of. And not just barriers. What are the barriers, but also what are some of the advice that you can give them to things that they could be doing and being intentional about doing so they can sort of level up in their role?
One thing that I was very clear and precise about, because I knew that I didn't want to stay at a case officer level, I knew I had to do more or identify areas in the service that is having issues and try and find solutions. So for example, the first case officer role I had that when I completed my master's. So there was a constant issue in the service about overspend. So spending money on basically sending young people with educational healthcare plans to independent out-of-borough schools that are costing 70, 80 grand a year. So what I done was I basically done an audit and I got all of the young people that are at these settings and I got the costings for each of them. And I spoke to our head of service and I was like, look, we've got 10 people at these settings and it's costing us 90, 100 grand each. We're basically almost like $1 million+ overspend.
Mm.
So what I done was I basically used that to create my own project to bring these young people back into the local settings. So what I done was I spoke to speech and language therapists, educational psychologists, and I got them to reassess these young people. So we got a up-to-date view of their needs, updated their educational healthcare plans, and we reconsulted with the local schools, and we managed to get about 7 of them back into the local schools. So that basically cut our overspend. So you have to be proactive and find issues and seek to resolve, because they can't deny it. Especially when it comes to money, they don't want to spend too much money. So if you can find areas around that, that would be good. Or I've seen other people do things like having coffee mornings with parents. Mm. So case officers, they're taking their own time, their own money to go and buy a coffee, go and buy biscuits. And they're inviting parents in to just speak to them, because with parents, it can be quite hostile and difficult to engage with them. So they're putting them in a relaxed space and they're just listening to them. Nothing crazy. It's not written work, but it's a way of building up relations and building up rapport. So you have to kind of think outside of the box. You're going to have your casework. You're going to have your assessments. You're going to have to do your deadlines. But if you can think of doing something outside of that, it doesn't need to be too strenuous. Mm. That would be a good thing. We had an issue with the special schools when I used to work in a local authority where they were having a lot of behaviour issues. So what I'd done was I emailed all of the head teachers of those special schools within that bar. It was like about 4 special schools. So I suggested that each term we're going to meet and we're going to talk about the behaviour policies and look at what each school does in terms of managing the behaviour. So one term we'll have a meeting in one special school with all of the heads there. We'll go back and reflect. And then over time, we started to have less issues because they were looking and learning from each other. Mm. So these are some of the things that you have to do. Nobody told me I had to do it. I just knew that the only way for me to move upwards, so when I'm having these interviews, whether it's an internal interview or external interview, I can demonstrate clearly, okay, in terms of my day-to-day, I'll do that, but I was able to do this on top of it as well. Yeah. That's what takes you to the next level.
Yeah. That was a job interview response, but yeah. You might as well just clip this bit out and then just say, you know what, listen, just watch this, man. This is my job interview.
That's the gem. Doing something that people aren't thinking of, and maybe they thought about it, but they haven't lent into it and gone for it. You have to think outside of the box, especially in this kind of field.
Yeah, and I think in most fields, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, I try to do is not only in terms of like the podcast or my mm-hmm. consulting, but even in terms of work, I think to myself, like, what connections can I build? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, who can I link in with? Like, mm-hmm. what can I be doing so that I'm bringing something to...
More value.
You know, more value to the team.
Facts.
And all I've maybe had to do is just send an email saying, oh, you know what? We've got these young people in this sort of area. Mm-hmm. Like, we want to do a summer program for them. Is there anything that you can offer?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it.
You know, those type of things. And it's funny because I literally had that sort of meeting like within the last 2 weeks where I brought a new like organization to work with the young people in the local authority.
Okay, good.
That I work with because we do like summer programs for them. And because, you know, they're hard to reach. They're on the periphery of like exclusion and whatever. So we offer them, you know, experiences like going to like cooking experience, going to Arsenal Stadium, like all of these sort of things, like Snapchat headquarters. Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. you know, these are people who wouldn't have had these, you know, experiences, but I'm just thinking on my feet, how can I add value mm-hmm. to what, you know, I'm bringing to the team? So that's very important.
Yeah, I think one thing I'll also say as well is one thing that's helped me in my career moving all the way up and even setting up my own consultancy is I can't reiterate the point enough about maintaining and building relationships. I would say I've done a master's, I've got a lot of experience, that's fine. But what's taking me to the next level is the relationships I've had with people. I remember I worked for a local authority. I was an annual reviews team manager there. Our head of service left. He went to another local authority. He backdoored my agency and he's like, look, because I was a contractor at the time. He's like, whatever day rate you want, I will pay. Just let me know and I'll give you a start date. That's because me and him had a really good relationship. And it's funny because we obviously used to talk about work, but we used to talk about football and traveling a lot as well. He always used to talk about his kids to me as well, but I genuinely found him interesting. But I think if I never had those conversations with him and we just spoke about work, that's it. I wouldn't have had those sorts of offers. Like every step of the way, someone's always advocated to me like, oh, what? No, you need to interview him. Might be like, oh, you need to give him a job, but interview him at least, or just speak to him, hear what he has to say. That's what helps a lot as well. Building relationships, I can't stress that. You can't burn your bridges. And obviously there's work politics everywhere, but if you can stay out of that as much as possible, then you're good. But building relationships, it's important. Like, look, if we didn't go to school together, I probably wouldn't even be here. Yeah. It's all of those relationships. It's important.
Yeah. And staying connected as well. When I think...
Facts, yeah.
There was a post on Instagram. This was about maybe 2-3 weeks ago. Jamelia, who's the CEO of Tres the Tres, like the UK Afro women's like hair mm-hmm. company. And then she was talking about the importance of not just having contacts, but connection.
Yeah.
Like there's people on your phone that you can connect with yeah. that will benefit you,
yeah.
but you're just leaving them on your phone.
You're just there.
You're just leaving there. Them as a follower or as yeah. a connect on yeah. LinkedIn. And yeah. you're not saying, you know, how are you? What events you got coming up? Let me come to this talk that yeah. you're doing. Or I've got this thing, you know, feel free to come, you know, let's discuss how we can collaborate and all of these things. Because contacts, they just sit on your phone.
Yeah,
they just sit on your phone and they don't do anything. But how are you building those connections where, you know, people can't, not only can people help further your career, but you can be conscious of actually, what can I do for you as well? And making it genuine mm-hmm, in terms of actually, we have, you know, we have a rapport, we have yeah. a common interest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, beyond everything, like we've got a purpose. Whether the thing that you're connected on is maybe based on just the fact that you're both ambitious, or you're that's both enough. Entrepreneurs,
yeah.
or you're both working in education as mm-hmm, consultants. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to connect with you. Like, what's,
yeah.
like, how are you doing SEM Bites?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
how did you do the website?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
how are you
yeah.
running that event that you're doing?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
you know. Let me get those gems for you, because mm-hmm. if I'm doing the same thing, I've already got pointers without having to go to Google and all of these things, which will give me generic, you know, advice when I've already got, you know, a contact there. So I think that's very, very, you know, important.
Yeah, and what you said is quite powerful, because you have to meet people halfway as well, and sometimes it's not always about you as well. Because another thing that I think has propelled me is that I've helped a lot of people get jobs. Like, I've helped a lot of people in my field get employment. Like, I've had agencies email me that, Nana, we've got this role available. I'm like, no, it's not for me, but I've got X, Y, Z. And then that person calls me, he's like, oh, yo, I've got a job. One lady that I used to work with, she messaged me. She's like, my friend wants to get X, Y, Z job. She's got a few interviews and roles coming up. Can I send her your CV, have a look at it? I don't know her from nowhere.
Mm.
The friend, I know the person I'm speaking to, but I don't know who the people she's speaking for. And I just looked at the CV. I went through, I made like, not a lot of changes, certain changes, shipped it back to her. Then that lady, I think she added me on LinkedIn saying, thank you so much.
Yeah.
I've got this job, blah, blah, blah. So I think if you want, when you bless others, you'll get blessed as well.
Yeah.
Honestly, I didn't have to do that. I could have just, whatever.
Yeah.
But I've done it. I'm happy to like give up my time to help people, because ultimately all links to special yeah. educational needs.
That's important. And I wanted to know as well, like, SEND is such a niche area that not only do you need like the knowledge,
mm-hmm.
but you need the passion, because it's so like challenging and yeah. overwhelming. What made you get into it in the first place?
So strange, bro. It was like, so when I finished university, so I graduated from Brunel like 2010. So for 2 years after I graduated, I was just working in retail. I literally didn't know what I wanted to do. In fact, I went to Bonds to do voluntary work in the drama department. I didn't know what I literally had no clue what I wanted to do after. But when it was getting to that 2 year mark, I was like, I need to do something of substance. Mm. So I just started to apply to work in schools as a teaching assistant. I applied to work in this school in Town Hamlets called Phoenix School. But I didn't know it was a special school.
Okay.
I applied, and like literally they asked me a couple of questions and I got a job. That yeah. was it. I was like, okay, cool, I'm going to the school. And when I walked into the school, it's like, hold on, what? This is not what I thought I signed up for. But I was like, boy, and one, I need money. And so I need to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And then literally the first, I think probably what helped is that I was there for 2 years. The first year I worked in a class for young people that were like high functioning.
Yeah.
So it kind of eased me into it. And then the second year, I worked with young people with a complete different level of need that were like non-verbal, pre-verbal, highly challenging behavior. But I just got, I don't know why, maybe because I had no other option, but I just embraced it. Mm. And I just, that was it. Like literally, I was like, this is it. I've never worked in a mainstream school before.
Well,
never. When I went to Bonds Voluntary, obviously in the drama department, I've never worked in a mainstream school. I've only worked in special school. So I worked there for 2 years, and then I've done my master's in special needs.
Wow.
But yeah, like it was like, this isn't something that I never wanted to do. This wasn't my like dream career. I didn't know what my dream career was. I knew I wanted to be in education, but special needs was something. Even before I stepped foot in that school, even how my mind used to think about special educational needs was very limited. Yeah. In my head, it's like, if you've got like, maybe like Down syndrome or cerebral palsy or in a wheelchair, that's special needs. The whole world of autism, ADHD didn't really exist in me because I never had anybody in my family that had that.
Yeah, of course.
Never had any friends that had that. I went to a mainstream school, mainstream sixth form, university, we wasn't really seeing that. But when I worked in that school for 2 years, I learned a lot.
Yeah.
And I picked up more information when I was doing my master's as well. But yeah, like literally, it was not my plan. I just stumbled into it.
That's so interesting because I find that a lot of people that I've spoken to, you know, even guests that I've had on previously, when we talk about education and what brought them into education, rarely do I find people saying, oh yeah, you know, it's what I wanted to do from... People just fall into it.
Yeah.
And those people that fall into it, they're excelling. Like, they're doing, you know, amazing work. And sometimes that's what it is.
Yeah.
Like, you... Like education, teaching, you know, pastoral care or send support, it just finds you. And the people that really stand out for me are the people that are passionate about it. Like you know when someone's passionate
facts,
about
you can't fake it.
You can't fake
it. Especially in our fields, in education, you can't fake it.
You know, educate. Like if someone would say to me, Cole, like, who's the best social worker you've worked with? I've already got a name in my head. Who's the best teacher that you've ever seen?
Yeah.
Who's the best TA or whatever?
Because
you know, I've left their presence saying wow.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't say wow all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I just see education as, you know, a rhetoric. Like it's, you know, it's just a repeat. You come into school, you do the same things, like blah, 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 you go home.
Yeah.
But in the certain teachers, certain social workers, certain SEN experts, certain SENCOs, even when I work with like families, certain families, like certain parents, the way they support,
it's their a different kids, level. It's I'm a like, different level.
You're a parent.
Yeah, bro. There's parents. Yeah.
You know, there's parents and there's parents.
There's levels.
There's teachers and there's teachers.
Facts.
And you see it. And I think the one thing that stands out for all of them is the passion.
Yeah, that's when
at someone the heart ain't of got it. Passion, you can tell, man.
Yeah,
that's you can tell they're just there for the paycheck. You can just tell they're, you know, waiting for. You know, the Friday and whatever else and just go to the pub or whatever.
This is it. It's the passion. Because even when I started, I was working as a TA, I was probably getting like $8.50 a month.
Yeah.
I've done it for 2 years, bro. So, and I'm sure I could have moved on to get a job that paid way more, but it's the passion that was driving me. Like, even though the kids were very challenging to work with, they were very difficult, I was excited to go to work in that school. And I was learning every day. And the people that I worked with, working with a good team obviously helps as well.
Yeah.
Because when you work in a special school, the classes are a lot smaller and you got, there's more, there's a higher staff to people ratio.
Yeah.
So you have like, let's say you got 8 kids, you have like 5 TAs.
Yeah, wow.
And you have to work as a team family for this to work. Otherwise, because if one thing goes wrong, then your whole day, week is a write-off.
Yeah.
So you have to like learn very quickly how to work with the young people, build a relationship with them and build a relationship with your team as well. So it all goes back to relationships and passion. That's at the heart of it.
Yeah, that's important. I wanted to ask as well, if there's one thing that like you would want to change about like SEN education in the UK, like what would that be? I know there's many things because we can't always get it right, but if you had to pick like one thing that you always find a, you know, as a challenge or, you know, whether you go from local authority to local authority or from school to school, it's like the same things that keeps coming up. Like, what would that one thing be?
I think there needs to be more emphasis on the type of training that practitioners get, whether it's a teacher assistant, teachers, SENCOs, head teachers. There's always talk about money and funding. I'm not saying there's an unlimited pot of money, but because of the roles I've had, I've seen money pass through my hands. I've agreed highly expensive placements. There's money. There's so much money. But then a lot of times you're giving money and the person that's on the other end receiving that money hasn't got a lot of experience, confidence, or training to deliver what that money is supposed to be doing.
Mm.
So there needs to be a lot of, whether it's CPD, whether it's masters, or maybe they go back and they resit whatever course that they have done, there needs to be a lot more training, because if you're...
Training in what field? Like, what do practitioners, teachers, and educators need to really upskill themselves around SEN? Is there anything specific?
So me personally, I think definitely in terms of the behavior aspect and how behavior is interpreted as well, because a lot of times behavior is a form of communication, but then it's difficult because if you're a teacher now and you're 50 years old and all your life you've dealt with one type of young person, when you're dealing with these type of young person, what worked 20 years ago isn't going to work now. So I need to constantly update. It's like my sister, she's a doctor. So she constantly has to do training to upskill herself because in the medical practice, things change all the time. And I feel like in SEN, a lot of people are still stuck 20 years ago, whereas now a lot of things have changed and advanced. So they need to make sure that they're keeping up to date. So whether it's managing behavior or if it's like meeting them with their communication, whether it's using assistive communication when it comes to young people that are pre-verbal or non-verbal, there's a lot of training and expertise that needs to get, they need to hone in a lot more on that aspect. I don't think it's about money. There's money. They injected like, was it 300 million last year after whatever governmental review. There's money. Like, there's, if I can't even reiterate how much money there is. Some of these school placements are charging, and it's not residential placements, just day placements, 100 grand a year per head, per student. There's money.
Yeah.
It's about the expertise and the knowledge in terms of how to deliver curriculum to these young people or even shift the curriculum completely.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as practitioners and educators, sometimes we have to be intentional. Don't just sit around. Like, there's CPD out there. There's stuff that's free. Even the stuff that's not free, ask your managers. Like,
they'll, you know, invest. What? Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's this training I want to do. Mm-hmm. Like, it costs X amount of money. Like, can the local authority or can the company or can the school pay for it? Because ultimately, if you're investing in your, you know, employees' future and they're upskilling themselves, you're only getting a better employee.
Exactly. You're getting
someone who's, you know, who's holding their skills and they're better equipped and fully equipped to be able to support, you know,
the
students and the school or the local authority. So I think, you know, practitioners and educators within that field being, you know, intentional in doing that, because that's something that
I agree.
I do as well, because I'm thinking, what have I got to lose? If I send you the email, you're just going to say yes or you're going to say no. Yeah, there's a 50% chance.
Yeah,
whereas you don't do it, that's 0% chance. So the odds are better for you just sending the email and communicating that. So I think that's definitely important. And as we finish off, I wanted to talk a bit about your consultancy. So why SEN Bites? Like, why did you, you know, create it? What gap did you see that you felt that SEN Bites would be, you know, necessary for our community and the wider society?
I feel like when I started SEN Bites, so in fact, I had the idea during COVID to actually start it. But because I just got promoted to senior management, I think I was feeling myself a bit too much. I was like, I don't need this business. And two, because it was COVID and it was serious lockdown, I was like, I don't even know how I would even execute this. So I kind of just left it. But then I think timing is everything, because over the years, I've worked my way up to even service manager level. And I've noticed a lot of things at each level. So there are gaps in schools in terms of how to support and manage young people that have special educational needs. So they need consultancy. Even SENCOs, when it comes to them applying for educational health and care plans, because I work on the other side and I receive them, a lot of them are rubbish. So they need consultancy advice in terms of how to actually do that comprehensive application and submit it and bring it in. Parents don't know how to navigate the system. So I've got a client that has got children that have special educational needs, and I'm in the process of helping her apply for an educational health and care plan. I've got two care homes that I'm working with right now, and they've got. So, for example, one of them approached me and gave me their proposal. So they want to set it up for. It's a home that's got that can fit five young people. So they want to have. They want to set up as a home for children with autism.
Yeah.
So five children. But when they sent me the proposal, they also said they want to use it as a crisis center. So basically, if they have a referral from social care, a young person gone into crisis having a meltdown, they'll take them on as well. But I had to push back and challenge them because I was like, if you've got four young people in home that got autism and they're settled, if you now bring in someone that's having a crisis, that's going to trigger all of those young people. So I had to push back on that as well. Also, they've indicated that it's for young people with autism or on the pathway, so they're awaiting diagnosis. So I've gone back and I've challenged them, like, if they go for the assessment and don't have autism, what are you going to do? Are you going to kick him or her out? How does that make sense? So there's loads of gaps in different areas and different services. So gaps in the school, families, that's another big gap in area as well. Some of these care homes as well, even educational psychologists as well. As much as they do assessments and they write reports on young people that have special educational needs, there's some areas that they struggle in terms of making it clear what that child needs in terms of the provision they need in the classroom as well, or support they need outside of the school as well. So that's with me initially, when I set it up, it was geared towards parents only, but because I've got such a wide range of experience working for local authorities as well, their budgets as well, they don't know how to manage that as well. If they're having staff restructures, I've supported with that in different local authorities as well. So that's something that my service offers as well.
No, that's amazing. That's amazing. Thank you. Thank you again for sharing that. You know, just for sharing the amazing, you know, work that you've been doing.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Over the time. And, you know, I'll definitely share your, you know, consultancy.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yes,
your consultancy details when we're sharing the episode. And, you know, let's continue.
Yeah, we need to do this again. Work, yeah.
And, you know, within our field and connect and really just, you know, use this opportunity, which I have today, to amplify the voices of the amazing people, the experts within our field, you know, who are doing that work. So thank you.
I'll connect you again with some other people as well that are doing similar things. Or even sometimes it's good to connect with people that are doing something completely different, but walking in the same path as well.
Yeah, so that's important.
Even when I launched SEM Bites, I wasn't thinking about care homes, but two have approached me to do work with me.
Yeah.
Which is, I didn't plan for that to happen, but it's happened. It's like two different, but it's like two worlds colliding.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. Thank you again. So this has been the Too Cool for School podcast. I am your host, Yannick. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow us on our social media platforms and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Thank you.